Call the next case.
Davidson versus Cosmo, David Target, Helen Council, Virginia Tyson, Peter Attorney General, Florida Commonwealth.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Lemons, and may it please the court. My name is David Hargett, represent Mr. Davidson on his appeal of his convictions out of the city of Fredericksburg. This case essentially comes down to whether or not a jury instruction should have been separated out for what we consider to be distinct paths in order to find someone guilty. And essentially what we're saying is that where you have a case such as this, where the distinct paths, whether you call it a theory or a path or what have you, or different elements, then by definition it needs to be separated out to avoid the possibility of not only confusion, but that the jury does not reach a unanimous verdict.
In other words, your concern is that the jury agreed on this theory, some of them, and on that theory on the other, and for that reason you can't get a unanimous verdict on any theory.
That's correct. That's correct. Because essentially, it was either, certainly it's possible, and we don't know what, we weren't in the jury room, we don't have anything from the jury to indicate what they were doing other than their verdicts. They did ask a few questions, which I can address if necessary. But we weren't in the jury room.
Is it necessary for that? I mean, the alternative theories are force or incapacity or helplessness. If a unanimous jury finds that it was done by one or the other, why is it necessary?
Well, because the jury wasn't asked to find it was done by one or the other. It was a combined instruction, which imagine the situation where, so there was a question about consent and there was a question about capacity. So they're both very volatile questions in this case. And so it's certainly possible that half of the jury could have found that there was consent, but yet she was incapacitated. And so that didn't count. The other half could think
that's
that
not
was
consent. If she's incapacitated, that's not consent.
Well, we might see it that way. I don't know that a jury would see it that way.
Well, I think a jury would see it that way.
Okay.
She's incapacitated, she's unconscious, and she's consenting?
Well, unconscious doesn't necessarily flow from these facts, so I don't necessarily agree with that assessment. But yeah, certainly somebody can say, I consent to something, and yet still lack the capacity to give consent. So it's really a question of the factual determination of consent versus the legal determination of consent, isn't it? I think that it is. And so when you look at the elements of the offense specifically, and we have two different charges here that we're talking about. One is aggravated sexual battery. That requires four elements: sexual abuse against the will, by force, and cause serious harm. The other path is sexual abuse accomplished through incapacity or helplessness, and that the defendant knew or should have known that she was in that condition and took advantage of it. So those are clearly different paths that have different elements. And if you look at it really closely, where the Court of Appeals kind of hung their hat was to say that this is really a question of against the will. That's the only element that really matters here. This only real difference is whether it was against her will. And these are two different ways to get there. But if you notice what I just said in the second avenue for aggravated sexual battery, against the will isn't in there. It's just simply sexual abuse accomplished through incapacity or helplessness for which the defendant knew or should have known.
How would your theory work with robbery, force, threat, or intimidation? A jury, would you say in a robbery case under your construct of how the constituent element should be defined that you've got to have 12 members of the jury on force or threat or intimidation? You couldn't have, you know, 4-4-4.
No, I mean, that's one element. That's a one-element case with multiple options in it, just like a deadly weapon. I mean, we don't ask the jury to decide what the deadly weapon was. If they found that no use of the deadly weapon was used, then that satisfies that element.
Why is this like that?
Because they are completely different elements. As I've just gone through with the aggravated sexual battery.
Well, force is very different from intimidation. Force is grabbing them by the throat and taking their money in a robbery case. And intimidation is intimidating them. It could be perfectly purely verbal.
It certainly could be verbal. The threat could be verbal as well. Some people would say that's a forceful thing. So, whether the legal definition of force works or not is maybe an issue. But in a robbery case, you don't necessarily define those distinctions. And as a matter of fact, you don't look at what the defendant was thinking to determine force, threat, or intimidation. You look at what the defendant was thinking in order to go the path of helplessness or incapacity. So maybe it isn't quite as easy to define it as a difference between a general intent crime versus a specific intent crime, but you have an added element that has to do with the defendant's state of mind to go that path, that doesn't exist to go the other path. And it is certainly possible that a jury could say, we don't necessarily know whether it was this or that. And some of them may say it was this, some of them may have said it was that, and they get back in the jury room because they're giving no other information whatsoever on how to resolve this. And they just simply say, well, some of us agree on this, some of us agree on that, so we'll just find them guilty.
Why isn't this speculative? I don't want to recite from the bench the facts of the case, but this was a very violent attack with some serious physical injuries and a tremendous loss of blood. Why are we even debating these nuances? There's no doubt that that all of these elements were found.
I disagree that this was an attack. If you look at the consent element, she left voluntarily. She went to go have some fun, as she says. When she left, she was perfectly fine and alert. When she got back, she was perfectly fine and alert. She made a phone call as she was leaving to say, I'm going out. We're going to be gone for a little bit. We'll be right back. She had this vague visualization later on, they had called a flashback, that's the only way you even got force in this case. Just because there's an injury doesn't mean that it wasn't voluntary.
The bruises and the stitches, doesn't that count for something on the force point?
It could, but it doesn't. Certainly there are cases and there are situations where somebody can consent to harm or consent to an act that then causes harm. That is not outside the realm of possibility.
I understand the consent point, but on the force point, it's pretty graphic.
You don't think the rectal injury is not on its face anatomically very suggestive of the use of force against her will?
It indicates that she was injured. It is a leap, I think, to then say we know for a fact that that means that it was by force against her will. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, if you look at what she did when she came back, if we want to talk about force, then we got to also understand that, as the court ruled, the only way the jury got to force was through this flashback, which I would argue isn't even admissible in the first place, but that wasn't addressed at trial. So that's all you have about being held down. It wasn't because that she was injured. And again, you can consent to conduct that then causes injury. It doesn't mean the person who committed a crime. So again, these are very different concepts, and I understand that the facts aren't favorable with regard to the injury, but I will point out that the jury did find him not guilty of two counts of unlawful wounding with regard to other offenses. So it wasn't as if this was a slam dunk. And keep in mind also that the facts of the case are quite clear. She left. She wasn't stumbling drunk. She was regarded as a strong woman. The bartender talked about how the fact that she wasn't slurring words or anything, she was fine. She makes the phone call. She comes back shortly thereafter. She's fully alert. She's a 15 out of a 15 on the Glasgow coma scale. So she's fully aware of who she is and what she's doing. She doesn't want to call the police. She doesn't want to get medical treatment. She just wants to go home, and she doesn't make an allegation whatsoever that the defendant did anything wrong. So if you look at it from those standpoints, and this is really kind of getting ahead of myself, because that's really talking about harmless error. We're not talking about whether the jury instruction should have been given. Now we're talking about, well, does it really matter? Because I think we got to step back and first say, should it have been given this way? And absolutely it needs to be given this way. As I pointed out, the model jury instruction addresses this. There are two separate paths to get there. There are two separate jury instructions. And I've articulated, you know, I don't exactly know how I would handle it if I were at trial. I imagine I would have handled it differently. But one of the ways that you avoid the lack of a unanimous verdict is that you simply have a jury verdict form that says, we find unanimously that this path or this path or not guilty.
Were there any objections to the verdict form itself?
Not the verdict form itself, no. But the two different paths certainly was the argument from pretrial all the way through the end of the case.
The Commonwealth argues approbate, reprobate with respect to the instructions. Can you address that?
Sure. For one, it doesn't apply. I'm simply making an argument. As far as the verdict form, I think is where they're really pointing their that's really the target of that argument. I'm simply just addressing that there was another avenue to get a unanimous verdict, and by giving a jury instruction that does that. But secondly, if you look at the jury instruction that was proposed, it reads more like stereo instructions than a jury instruction. Third, this issue wasn't raised at the Court of Appeals, and if you're going to say that now we have somehow procedurally defaulted because of what the attorney argued at trial, and it has never been addressed at the Court of Appeals level, then one, the Court of Appeals should have addressed this, and why didn't they? Because it wasn't raised. So if they had raised it, fine, it should have been addressed. If it wasn't addressed, fine, you should have assigned cross error for the Court of Appeals failing to rule that it's procedurally defaulted.
Except
but none
the fact
of that happened.
That appellees don't have to raise below right result, wrong reason.
I don't see the...
If it's a question of law and it doesn't involve a matter of determining fact or an exercise of trial court discretion, they can raise it on appeal for the first time.
I disagree with that. I don't think that it's a matter of right for the wrong reason. That's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about whether the argument has now been waived based on what happened at trial, and they never brought it up at the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals never ruled on it, and then they never assigned error to the Court of Appeals failing to address it. I will say just briefly before I reserve the remainder of my time, there is also the forcible sodomy instruction, and the elements are again different. One path is sex against the will by force. The other one is sex against the will through incapacity, and the defendant knew or should have known and took advantage of that. Again, we're in the same boat. It's a little bit different because in both paths there is the against the will part, unlike the aggravated sexual battery, but it needs to be in there, and it needs to be said to the jury so that the jury understands when they reach a verdict, and we can be confident that we know that they all agreed that this is what happened. And I understand that it's difficult to separate them out, but that's exactly what needed to be done based on the fact that these are different paths because they are different elements. And the elements is what makes the difference. I would reserve the remainder of my time.
239.
May it please the court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. In order to convict Davison of sodomy, the jury was required to unanimously find that Davison penetrated the anus of the victim without her consent. The jurors were not required to unanimously concur as to whether that act was committed by force or through the victim's mental incapacity or physical helplessness. Likewise, with the aggravated sexual battery charge, the jury was required to unanimously find that Davison sexually abused the victim without her consent. Those are the elements. The mode, the method of commission is not an element. And it is not necessary for unanimous concurrence with regard to facts that go to the method or mode of commission. Now, the Court of Appeals relied, in its opinion, on Shad versus Arizona, where Arizona had first-degree murder, and it could be proven either as premeditated murder or felony murder. And because either way you ended up with first-degree murder, the plurality opinion by Justice Souter pointed out that it was not necessary to have unanimity as to whether it was premeditated or felony murder. And in fact, the Scalia concurrence broadened really rather than narrowed that plurality. And so today, counsel argues about different paths. But different paths is not a different element. The different path is the different mode or the of commission or the method of commission. And so it was not necessary for the jury to be unanimous in that regard. I think yes, ma'am.
The jury instructions that were given here, I believe at the top they say, as most jury instructions do, that you have to prove the following elements. And then you have listed these different paths or different means or whatever they are. To the extent that the jury has been told that these are elements, doesn't the jury instruction in this case make them elements, whether they might be paths or means or otherwise? What's the significance of that, if any?
I don't think that putting the word element in the jury instruction would alter the analysis of whether it is an element or it is a method of committing the offense. The element that the jury had to find was that this was against the will. This was without the consent of the victim. And they were able to find that. And, of course, the disjunctive was used in a couple of different ways, either through force, and threatened intimidation was not there, through force or through the use of the victim's mental incapacity or physical helplessness. And so, I think the example that was given in the Richardson case from the United States Supreme Court was about robbery, and that when you have a robbery, you have to have force or threat of force. And if some of the jurors believed he used a gun and some of the jurors believed that he used a knife, as long as the jurors found that there was that force or threat of force, then that was the unanimity that was required. And the same thing happened in the instant case, especially because there was ample and overwhelming evidence of each of the ways in which these crimes could be committed. And this really is a case of first impression for this on the merits for this court. And I think as everyone, both parties have agreed, when Molina came through, the Court of Appeals assumed without deciding that it was error to put both of those means of commission in the same instruction. And this court found it had not been preserved. And so now we are here. And I will say in response to some of the discussion between Justice Kelsey and Mr. Hargett, that it is our position, and it's our position today in oral argument, that there any complaint about the verdict form has been waived. I think that the record is pretty clear that these instructions were objected to on the grounds that they should not be in the same jury instruction. But when a fact is not an element, there is no need for unanimity. And there can be facts that are elements. And we certainly recognize that. And in that instance, the jury would be required to find unanimously a fact. The age of a victim of felony child neglect under 18.2371.1. If the child isn't under 18, well, that's an element. The child must be under 18.
Imagine the practical consequence of doing a jury instruction this way. Members of the jury, if this anal rape occurred against her will because of a threat, her will is overcome by a threat, find him guilty. Members of the jury, this anal rape, if it was committed against her when she was in a state of mental incapacity or physical helplessness, you may find her guilty. But if half of you find that it was a threat and half of you find merely that he overcame her will because of her mental incapacity, you have to acquit him. Can you imagine what a jury would think of that?
Well, and Your Honor, I think that is in the concurrence that Justice Scalia wrote in the Shad versus Arizona opinion is very similar to the analysis or the theory that you have just posited. And, of course, he did not agree with that happening as well. I suppose we could go with some other examples of things that occur that can occur by different means. And you could have the death of a toddler who has bathwater in his lungs and shows signs of suffocation. And if the Commonwealth or the government has proved that the homicide occurred of this toddler, not through natural means, it's not necessary for the jury to decide whether the bathwater means he was drowned or the signs of suffocation means that he was suffocated. The important decision and the unanimous decision of a jury is that homicide occurred, that the death occurred through non-natural means. Now, I think that it's interesting that the model jury instruction for sodomy doesn't mention mental incapacity or physical helplessness at all. So I don't think we can look to the model jury instructions and say, well, if the model doesn't have it, then you know, we must do it another way. It's in the practice commentary following the sodomy, forcible sodomy instruction, that this crime can be proved that way.
Right, and the introductory chapter points out instructions have to be adapted to fit. And so it may be that a robbery has multiple options or this crime has multiple options, in which case you need to tailor the instructions.
Yes, and that's absolutely correct. Here we had instructions on aggravated sexual battery. It's on page 848. The sodomy is on 849. And there was a consent instruction. And that's instruction number 25, which is at 855. And what that instruction told the jury was that if there was consent from the victim, it is an absolute bar to conviction for these crimes. So the jury understood that it must find that there was not consent for either of these crimes. And then if we look at the evidence that was presented, it's our position that there was overwhelming evidence of each one of these modes of commission or methods of commission. And I must disagree with my opposing counsel on several points with regard to what the evidence showed. And he argued with regard to the mental incapacity about a scale that, and there was testimony before the jury about this scale that the first responder used. But I would draw the court's attention to Joint Appendix 904, where we see that her blood alcohol content several hours after this offense was 0.244. And the Commonwealth presented evidence from an expert about what the effects of alcohol at different levels would be on someone's abilities. And as I recall, just paraphrasing, I think that at 0.2 and beyond, that the expert testified that the individual may really just be trying to stay upright. And hers was 0.244. There was testimony from the same
nurse.
There's
evidence in conflict there, right? I mean, on the other side about how she conducted herself at the bar and then went. So understand, that's compelling evidence that the jury may have credited, but there is the other side. That
and, Your Honor, the one thing that I would say in response to that is that this is a blood alcohol test, and it's three times what the legal limit is to drive. And so whether someone had a more subjective test about how she was doing, we know from the surgeon that the only medication that was given to her was a saline solution because she had lost so much of her blood that she had to have this treatment. But that was the only treatment that was done. We also have the evidence from
the stitching.
Pardon me?
And the stitching.
Your Honor, the same nurse couldn't even do the examination initially on this victim. But with regard to mental incapacity, which was what I wanted to address, was the same nurse indicated she couldn't sign the consent form. Her friend who accompanied her had to give verbal consent. So there is much evidence of mental incapacity. And the blood alcohol sample was taken at 4:25 a.m.
And my only point went to any possible harmless error. I think on this record it'd be a tougher call than might otherwise be the case, given the testimony on the other side.
I'm sorry, Aaron, I didn't understand.
No, continue with the argument.
With regard to the force that was shown, I do think the bruises and having bruises throughout her body and not just on the places where the sexual contact occurred is significant in establishing that force. And there was so much blood in the parking lot that the fire department decided that they needed to hose it off with the fire hose, even though it was raining that night. And, of course, the doctor testified about the tremendous amount of blood that was lost. So the same nurse could not complete the examination until after surgery by the surgeon, life-saving surgery because of the blood that had been lost by this particular victim. And then with regard to physical helplessness, we really need to get past blacking out into the unconscious state. And the expert testified with regard to a blackout and a pass out and the sort of the differences between those. And the victim could not recall what had happened, but she did have the flashback, and that was admitted into evidence which would support the force for the sodomy charge. And I think that we look at the evidence of the injuries with regard to force on the aggravated sexual battery, because those were the injuries with regard to the other offense. And so it's certainly not our position that this court needs to get to harmless error. Our position is that unanimity was not required for the mode of commission, and that in following what the Supreme Court of the United States said in Shad, and Richardson, even the Richardson case where it didn't go the government's way because the court found that actually with continuing criminal enterprise, all of the drug offenses are elements. But the Supreme Court looked at the same issue that the court did in Shad and noted that where you have which of the several means used to commit the element, if that's the issue, then unanimity is not required. What is required is that the jury find the elements have been proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and the elements here involved whether or not there was consent by this victim. And the jury unanimously concluded that there had not been, and they convicted Davison of these two charges. And the jury instruction was not improper. If this court even were to find that it was, any error would be harmless. We would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals of Virginia and the City of Fredericksburg.
Mr. Harder.
The jury did not understand consent, not to the satisfaction of the jury anyway. Page 802 of the appendix. We have a question from the jury. What's the legal definition of consent? They're struggling with it. They don't know. How do you define an element?
Can I ask you this? The Attorney General says in its brief that the victim lost approximately half the blood in her body as a result of this assault. Is that a fair representation of the evidence?
I don't believe half the blood in her body would be accurate. I mean, I think that's a bit of an overstatement.
If it were,
I think there was an argument to that effect.
Was there evidence, because there's a citation for it, I'll look it up as soon as I get off the bench, for half the blood in her body was lost as a result of this allegedly consensual encounter?
I mean, honestly, I don't know how somebody lives if half their blood is gone, but I would disagree that necessarily the injury means that the jury is properly instructed. I don't see how you make that connection. I honestly don't. And matter of fact, again, what is an element of the offense? We're not talking about the injury. And you keep in mind, the jury found him not guilty of two counts of wounding. So we're not talking about the injury. You want to argue that proves something, fine. Let the jury make that decision as to whether they found it was consensual or found that it was against her capacity or through use of her incapacity or helplessness to which the defendant knew or should have known. Because that's what we're talking about, the mode and method. We're talking about kind of a state of the mind of the defendant as well. So what is an element? An element is defined by what needs to be proven. And what needs to be proven is two different things, then there are two different elements. As Justice Powell pointed out, the jury instructed these are elements, so the jury had to find the different elements. And the verdict form that I've suggested has not been waived because that's not really even the issue in the case. I'm basically saying there's another way to do it. And Justice Kelsey, if you want to talk about how this would look, it would have looked pretty simple. I mean, forget about the arguments that are made in this case because there are lots of them. But just generally speaking, moving forward, how hard would it be to have a verdict form that says, we find the jury unanimously finds the following. One, it was against the will with those part. Two, helplessness or incapacity. Or three, not guilty. Now we have a special verdict form, and we know exactly what the jury found, and we know it was unanimous. Under these facts, we don't know. And she did, by the way, consent to the exam. She was alert and was able to. That's page 139 of the joint appendix. Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.